This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Haven't we all seen this economic movie before? Fall approaches, the virus is in charge, lather, rinse, repeat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 13 September today, Monday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A couple of data points about this economy with which to begin today. Number one, it is, as I said, the 13th of September. That means there are 17 days left for Congress to approve a spending plan for the federal government lest it run out of money at the end of the fiscal year, which comes upon us September the 30th. I just thought you might like to know that. Item the second, the debt limit, which is, once again, money the government has to borrow to cover spending it has already done, not new spending. The deadline for that and for avoiding global financial disaster, if I could paraphrase Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, is October-ish sometime, which is like tomorrow. And I thought you might like to know that as well. But both of those are in service to item number three, our lead story today, which is that we are not the only player in this global economy, and all is not necessarily well elsewhere. No, we are not heading back into another global recession, probably, but there are some signs of cooling, both here and abroad. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes up his regular post for us today at the desk of economic peril.
A few months ago, a lot of economists saw a clear path to global recovery, paved by vaccination and stimulus from governments and central banks. Neil Shearing at Capital Economics was one of them. Now, he's not so sure.
In a number of the world's major economies, it's pretty clear now in the latest data that the recovery is running out of steam, particularly true in the US and in the UK, but it's also true of China.
Shearing has cut his quarterly growth forecast for advanced economies in half.
The most likely outcome is that growth slows rather than the recovery stalls altogether or even goes into reverse. The wild card, of course, is if we get another variant like the Delta variant that's perhaps even more virulent.
The Delta surge has depressed consumer confidence and spending in the developed world. But in the developing world, the economic impact is much worse, says Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
It's about the disease full stop, not having vaccines, not having health care. It's just a cloud over your economy for a long time.
Now, the lion's share of global GDP and most U.S. trade comes from the rich nations. They're facing ongoing supply chain disruptions, dragging down global growth. But political economist Sharon O'Halloran at Columbia University says those problems will likely get worked out in time as international businesses try to deal with the risks the pandemic exposed.
What we'll have to change to, and this is what you are seeing happening, is not only you're going to have a hub of production in China, you're now seeing increasing production coming into Mexico, Europe, and Southeast Asia, and so forth.
In other words, make sure we have multiple suppliers for raw materials and parts and finished goods all over the world. O'Halloran says that's crucial not only to deal with the pandemic, but increasingly frequent climate disasters as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, traders were in a better mood than last week, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We We got to talking in our news meeting this morning about how we kind of seem to have come full circle in talking about this economy and the virus, how all the stories are starting to sound the same, and how we all thought we'd be in a different place right now. Kristen Schwab reports from the Marketplace desk of Economic Deja Vu.
Has anyone else been feeling like life is a broken record? Like, I'm still working from home. One of my friends, who rescheduled her wedding reception from last fall, just canceled it altogether. And look, I'm just one consumer. But consumers' decisions impact businesses like Mario Ponce's. He owns a trio of Latin American restaurants in Chicago called Taquito.
I can't remember a more difficult time in forecasting the next quarter or two than it has now.
In the last few weeks, business has fallen about 30%. He's gone from desperately searching for workers to putting hiring on pause. Still, he's optimistic about the future after a good summer.
People want to go out. People demonstrated that restaurants matter.
He just feels like he's in a holding pattern. Bill Dunkelberg, an economist at the National Federation of Independent Business, says the economy itself is in one.
So uncertainty is there, and it's a guessing game right now.
Numbers show it. Last week's jobless claims hit a new pandemic low. But he says the labor force is still missing 5 million people from pre-COVID times. People are spending money, but how they're spending it matters. For instance, airlines say ticket sales are way down. Another indicator? Impatience. Eilat Fishback, a professor of behavior science and marketing at the University of Chicago, says preliminary research shows it's back to the level it was before the vaccine rollout.
People's expectations were so much more optimistic than what actually happened.
As in, lots of people thought we'd be done with this by now. And that affects how consumers feel and how they interact with the world.
I think I share the frustration that, not again.
But as we're in this holding pattern, Fishback says it's important to remind ourselves that we're getting closer. Her own reminders, she's teaching in person again, and her son is learning in person. He just started the fourth grade. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This might sound a little counterintuitive, but hang in with me here for a second, would you? You know how I say all the time how important consumers are to this economy? Same thing increasingly applies in China. Yes, there are systemic differences in our economies, but capitalism with Chinese characteristics now includes consumers. And as the world's second biggest economy recovers, along with the planet, as Mitchell was saying, slowly, domestic consumption, which is what economists say when they mean people buying stuff, that is way behind Chinese manufacturing and export, those industries there. So retailers are sharpening their focus on young consumers, women in particular. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack hit the streets of Shanghai to find out what people are willing to spend their money on.
Shanghai's TX Huaihai Mall is the trendiest place to see and be seen for college students, like finance major Zhou Hui. She has platinum blonde hair and coral lipstick paired with an oversized black t-shirt.
I can spend anywhere from $400 to $700 a month on clothing and eating out.
That didn't change even during the COVID-19 lockdown last year. She just spent more online. Zhou Hui is the type of consumer TX Mall is targeting. 18 to 25, and financially carefree, thanks in part to growing up under the one-child policy, says the head of the TX Mall project, Tiffany Xu.
They may have up to six adults, their parents, and both sets of grandparents taking care of them, and they don't have any housing pressures because as an only child, they inherit all of their parents' and grandparents' properties. That's why this generation is willing to spend.
And what they want to spend on are harder to get items, like what mall tenant ENG Clothing sells. The owner, Sherry Huang, says during this past year, her sales have increased a lot.
One reason is consumers can't leave China. The other is we choose popular items from the US and Europe that haven't arrived in China yet. That's why we have celebrity clients like actress Feng Bingbing buying from us.
No international travel has also been good for one Silicon Valley startup called BorderX Lab. Its e-commerce app links China's middle class to the likes of Harrods, Macy's, and Saks Fifth Avenue. CEO Albert Shen says about 70% of his customers are female.
In China, Chinese women usually the keeper of the purse and the driver of purchase decision for the family.
In China, this is called the she economy. Reliable numbers on its size are hard to come by. But young women are the dominant buyers when it comes to pets and wine, for example. And more of them are spending on video games. And their tastes are broadening.
When we started 6 years ago, the society developed a consumer culture by the trend. Everyone wants to like the same bags or same lipstick.
People bought brands to acquire status, Shin says. Now they're buying self-expression. Back at TX Mall, college grad Anxin is wearing a pair of blue and white Nike high tops, but says she won't buy more.
Because of the issue over the use of Xinjiang cotton, I stopped supporting Nike.
She's referring to Nike and other brands pledging to not source cotton from the Chinese western region of Xinjiang, where there are concerns of forced labor, an allegation the Chinese government denies. In response, China's Communist Youth League sparked a boycott of overseas firms. This comes at a time when more young people are coming around to Chinese brands. Again, ENG clothing boss Huang.
Right now, patriotism is popular, so I've also introduced some Chinese brands into our collection.
She says young people want to buy brands whose values they support, and they're willing to pay a premium. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
that 3 a.m. faucets leaking call.
One thing doctors and property managers have in common, those middle of the night emergency calls. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 261 today, about 0.75%, finished at 34,869. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 9 points, just shy of a 0.1%, 15,105. The S&P 500 added 10 points, about 0.2%, 44.68. The evidence does not appear to show a need for COVID booster shots. That's the conclusion of a review that appeared today in the medical journal The Lancet. They concluded current vaccine supplies would save more lives if they went to currently unvaccinated populations, and thus, shares in Pfizer down 2.2%. Moderna dropped 0.6% today. $3,000 a ton. That's price aluminum just hit on the London Metals Exchange, the highest it's been in 13 years. Shares in Alcoa down about 0.5%. Rio Tinto gained 0.4%. Bonds, I want to squeeze those in here. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.32%. Pretty narrow range for the 10-year yield lately, actually. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fifth largest economy in the world, if we counted California as a separate country, wraps up a big election tomorrow. Governor Gavin Newsom faces a recall, just in case you hadn't heard. And with all the attention on whether Newsom's going to be needing a moving truck, some other important news might get overlooked, because tomorrow is also when the Census Bureau is going to release poverty statistics for 2020, which I mentioned because last year, California had the highest poverty rate in the country. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains how the richest state in the union could also be the poorest.
The Census Bureau came out with a better way to measure poverty a decade ago, one that adjusts for the fact that, say, living in LA is a lot more expensive than living in Jackson, Mississippi. And even though California has one of the strongest social safety nets in the country, it has one of the highest poverty rates, 17% in 2019.
It's really housing costs outweighing the added benefit from social policy programs.
Caroline Danielson is with the Public Policy Institute of California. Even with record high unemployment, she expects last year's big boost in federal assistance to reduce California's poverty rate. But struggling Californians may benefit less than those in other states.
There's also the factor of immigration. So children are typically eligible for benefits, but sometimes their parents are not.
California has the highest share of immigrants in the country, and many of those families live in the Central Valley, a huge agricultural region that's often overshadowed by the Bay Area and LA. Chris Haney is director of the California Budget and Policy Center.
We're a big state, so, you know, in some respects, we have parts of the country that will look like the wealthiest of wealthy places, but we also have places that will be among the poorest.
Hundreds of thousands of low-income Californians have left the state in recent years. Michael Flood is CEO of the LA Regional Food Bank. He says relocating is a frequent topic among those who wait for hours outside the South LA headquarters. But
just picking up and, you know, moving to another city isn't necessarily going to be something that's successful.
Because rent-wise, other parts of the country are starting to look more and more like California. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The temperature in Austin, Texas today, mid to upper 80s, partly cloudy, a far, far cry from the freeze and the ice storm that took down that state's power grid. It killed hundreds of people and left millions more without power for days back at the beginning of the year. Over the summer, the Texas legislature did pass a couple of laws designed to make sure the same thing never happens again. But whether they actually got there? Marketplace's Andy Euler covers all things Texas for us.
Texas is exceptional in many ways. When it joined the Union, the state won the right to divide into five territories if it wanted to. And in the 1930s, Texans decided they didn't want to join either of the country's electricity grids, the one in the east or the one in the west.
Texas leaders decided they wanted to have their own grids. They wouldn't be subjected to federal regulation of electricity here.
Daniel Cohan at Rice University in Houston says the state's decision to block the feds from getting up in its business still has consequences.
We weren't imagining how vulnerable we would make ourselves by not being able to bring in power when we need it the most.
Like it did back in February. A winter storm sent temperatures tumbling. Suddenly, Texans were turning on their mostly electric heating systems. When demand spikes like that, Texas largely depends on natural gas power plants that can be fired up quickly. But the storm had frozen much of that system solid. Michael Weber is an energy resources professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
The power system depends on gas. The gas system depends on power. And so if you have a critical failure in one element, it can have a rippling effect through the others or a cascading series of failures. We saw that with this interdependence.
He says Texans learned of this vulnerability 10 years ago during a winter storm, but the legislature decided not to do anything. This time, lawmakers didn't have much of a choice.
A Killeen woman is now dealing with an electricity bill that's over $4,000.
$1,500, $4,900, and nearly $14,000.
At this point, his electric bill for this month is more than $17,000.
The spike in utility bills during the cold snap was a product of the state's deregulated power market, and it upset a lot of Texans. On June 8th, Governor Greg Abbott signed two bills establishing rules for the weatherization of power plants and transmission lines.
Everything that needed to be done was done to fix the power grid in Texas.
But Kelly Sanders at the University of Southern California thinks lawmakers are still just reacting.
There's a lot of things that need to happen, you know, from the Texas grid standpoint. And a lot of it is challenged by the way that the market is structured there.
Texas's electricity delivery system is market-based. There are private and competing generating companies, transmission companies, and energy retailers. Michael Weber at UT Austin says finding those companies if they don't weatherize is a good first step, but lawmakers still only looked into the supply side of the problem.
We could also manage demand. So it's the other major tool, the toolbox. In things like energy efficiencies, better building codes, demand response, those things were not touched for the most part.
And they also really dropped the ball on not doing anything on transmission.
That's Daniel Cohen at Rice University again.
Even if we don't become fully integrated with the national grid, to at least have more of those ties that could make us much more resilient and frankly could allow us to sell more of our wind and solar power at other times of the year.
Plugging Texas into the national grid would cost a lot of money, says Caitlin Smith. She's a Texas-based energy consultant at AB Power Advisors. It also wouldn't happen overnight.
That's a 20-year project, probably. There's limited things that you can do right off the bat.
Less than a week after the governor signed those Texas power reform bills into law, temperatures rose over 100 degrees in a lot of the state. The grid operator sent emails and ran ads urging customers to conserve electricity to avoid more rolling blackouts. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We heard from Kristen Schwab a little bit ago about the deja vu all over again that the Delta variant seems to be bringing us this fall. Restaurants closing for indoor dining again, mask mandates, and all the rest of the stuff that's the same but somehow different. We are going to end today with a little more deja vu. Zarish Khan is a medical doctor in Iowa City, Iowa. She told us on this program a couple of years ago about putting her dream of owning a home on hold so that she could start an education fund for her cousin's daughter after her cousin passed away. A lot has changed for this economy and for Dr. Khan since then, so here's an update.
So the last time we chatted, I had talked about how I put a lot of weight in buying a primary home for my family as a culmination of my American dream. So once my cousin passed away and I started looking at things more and more in terms of, you know, that life's kind of limited, I think I started thinking more in terms of living, in terms of experiences, and not in terms of things. Instead of looking at, you know, buying a primary home for ourselves, I started looking at doing real estate investment and buying pretty much rental homes, which will do two things. Number one, provide some retirement income, and then also provide value to the people who would live in those places, because it was not very long ago that I was a student myself. I could kind of feel how, you know, I just wanted to be a better landlord than sometimes I've had an experience of dealing with. One of those you cannot really blame on the landlord as the primary driver for the bad influence, but I lived in New York, which is obviously a really high cost of living area. And I was a cardiothoracic surgery fellow at that time, so we really did not earn much. And on top of that, I was pregnant at that time. So I remember looking at that very first paycheck and I asked myself, how am I going to eat? So right now I own 3 properties. So now I know how much hard work it takes and how costly it is to be a landlord. So I have a lot of empathy for my landlords, and all the times I complained, I now complain less. Actually, I've forgiven them for a lot of those things. I do feel, though, that that you should never have to look at your paycheck and say, how am I going to eat after I pay this rent? I don't have a property manager, so the money that I save from them, I'm able to give a lower rent to the renter. It comes with some additional headaches because, you know, obviously I have to be prepared for that 3 a.m. faucets leaking call. But if you've invested in your property upfront and you've ensured that it's a well-maintained property, then you don't get a lot of those calls. So in terms of buying a home for myself. I think, you know, dreams have a way of creeping back into your head. So we did eventually buy a primary home for ourselves. As happy as I am, I also feel that this is not everything that I was here for. I have, I have a broader horizon right now.
Dr. Zarish Khan, she's in Iowa City, Iowa. You can tell us about your adventures in housing at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, the day in which tacos become the latest subscription service. If you live in Tucson and have an affinity for tacos, you are in luck. Taco Bell is running a pilot program. Buy yourself a Taco Lover's Pass. That's what they're calling it. You can get a crunchy taco, a soft taco, a spicy potato soft taco, whatever that is, or Doritos Locos taco, which I happen to know what it is. One only, please, for 30 straight days, $5 to $10 a month, depending on which location you go to. And of course, since one taco is not going to fill you up, you are going to buy something else. And therein lies the genius of this whole thing. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context in which I got good news and I got bad news. The Treasury Department said today that the federal deficit for the first 11 months of the fiscal year, which ends, as I said earlier in the program, in 17 days, the deficit shrank $300 billion from the same period a year earlier. That's the good news. The bad news is that so far this fiscal year, we have spent $2.7 trillion with a T dollars more than we, that is to say the federal government, took in. To be clear, yes, these are extraordinary economic times. And yes, the government can borrow for rock bottom interest rates. I just thought you'd like to know is all. Our daily production team, Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Rial Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, right back here on APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.